Regular meeting of the Camry Community Services District Board of Directors is hereby called to order. Would you please join me in reciting the Pledge of Allegiance? Thanks to everyone for coming today and for those who are joining us via Zoom. We have a quorum. All the directors are here. And I think we have some people to do presentations too, a presentation, which will be item 5A on regular business. So hopefully we can get to that fairly soon. Mr. Carmel, I think you have a report from closed session to give us.
I do. Thank you, President Gray. At the September 19th, 2024 regular meeting, the board held a closed session for a public employee performance evaluation pursuant to Government Code Section 54957B. The position title was General Manager. No action was taken. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carmel. Moving on to the President's report, there is no President's report per se this time, so I'll move on to agenda review our section in which members of the board of directors may suggest changes to the agenda, i.e. either items being dropped or moved. Does anyone have any changes they want to make to the agenda? I see none. So move on to board member communications, in which any board member make an announcement, report briefly on their activities, or ask a question for clarification. Director Thomas.
Oh, thank you, President Gray. Just a couple of things in my volunteer role, coordinating the Fiscalini Ranch, Wednesday Weeders. Yesterday was our grand finale, the last day of the season, and the volunteers started January 31st, and pretty amazing. We had over 50 volunteers over the year, work a bit over 1,000 hours removing thistles, radish, poison hemlock, French broom, ice plant, you name it. And just a kudos to the partnership with the facilities and resources staff. Mid-year, they started bringing the trailer. And if you came in the parking lot, you see the Iron Panther out there. They started bringing that trailer within as close as it could possibly get to the work site, and I think that's doubled or tripled the ability of the volunteers to get invasives off the ranch, so that's been tremendous. So thank you for that. Wednesday, a week ago, I attended the San Luis Obispo Safe Streets Forum, hosted by SLOCOG. That's the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, and their mission is find ways to make the streets safer. They're working with trying to put in place local safety champions. No immediate action, but just a good connection to make in that regard. And I'm about towards the end of, I've been attending a 9-week California Forest Stewardship Workshop put on by the University of California Cooperative Extension. And really just dipping my toes into what it takes with the forestry professionals. So there's a lot of content there, and I've got at my fingertips a lot of tools and practices, but my goodness, what a body of knowledge registered professional foresters have at their avail. So thank you.
Thank you, Director Thomas. And Director Farmer, you have something too, right?
Yes, thank you. And along those lines of what Director Thomas was just talking about, I just want to mention, because I love the color of this, the Lambton Cliffs Restoration Project, which hasn't started yet, whereas opposed to what Director Thomas was just mentioning. So I just want to let you know, for those of you that probably know where Lambton Park is, it's right there on Marine Terrace, at the southernmost part of Marine Terrace. And there's an abundance of ice plant there, and the place isn't looking as good as it used to, so volunteers are being requested. There's going to be two ice plant pulling events, And for all I know, Director Thomas may be there. And they're going to be on two consecutive Tuesdays, not Saturdays or Wednesdays, but Tuesdays from 9 to 11 a.m. And this is coming up on October 22nd and October 29th. So basically, they need folks to do this hard work, pulling up ice plant and transporting the debris to a drying area, which is necessary. So if you're so inclined, plan to wear long sleeve shirts, long pants, sturdy closed-toed shoes, a hat, and durable gardening gloves. The knee pads would be useful as well. And also, volunteers are going to be needed to trim shrubbery and clear pathways. And by the way, water, snacks, and sunscreen will be provided too. So I just want to let you know this project has been a long time in coming. It's just the beginning. You know, removing the ice plant, they're going to be restoring native plants, and eventually this is going to create the most beautiful Lambton Park ever. So you don't have to live on Marine Terrace to want to assist in this project. So once again, it's ice plant pulling, but fun, and it's going to be from 9 to 11 a.m. on Tuesdays, October 22nd and October 29th. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Farmer.
Best workout you'll ever get.
Yeah. It's easy to pull, heavy to carry. Anybody else want to report on their activities or make comments? Okay. Thank you. Moving along, then, we go to public comment.
President Gray. We skipped acknowledgments.
I'm sorry about that.
That's all right.
Yeah. Let's go back to acknowledgments. Thank you. Mr. McElhenney, please proceed.
Thank you, President.
My apologies.
Great. No problem at all. Thank you, Board. We wanted to do an employee acknowledgement. As we know, our Facilities and Resources Department has been extremely strained with departures, individuals promoting to different agencies, and Mr. Aguirre and his team have been down to a team of two when they were a team of four. And so I'm going to bring up Mr. Aguirre to present to one of his staff members for excellent work.
Yeah. Board members, I just want to say, you know, with everything that's been going on, going from a four-man crew or a three-man crew down to a two, and let alone with one, this individual, I am very appreciative of everything that he has come in to, not knowing the way things are. And the way things that have they become, I just do have to say that he's been very pleasant to work with, and he's also picked up a lot of knowledge throughout the whole process. I know it's only been 8 months, but it's been a good hard 8 months, and I do have to say I'm very appreciative, me personally, and especially on the behalf of our department, what we can do for the community. So with that, that's something that I'd like to say thank you to Oscar. You know, just the appreciation that his dedication to our department, and especially to the CCSD.
A couple words, I guess. Well, thank you first and foremost for the opportunity to be involved with the district and furthermore with my community, born and raised here. I take pride in what we do and our department and just overall. So again, thank you from the bottom of my heart and my family to all you guys.
Thank you.
Of course.
All right. And I have one more. This is probably really long overdue. We have some superheroes in this district that don't get recognized very often. With this individual, you might not see a cape fluttering or a secret lair hidden beneath the district. But make no mistake, their superpowers are real, and they are full force every single day. Let's talk about their super speed, which this board is very aware of. In a single day, they can coordinate meetings, juggle complex schedules, and keep the entire district running smoothly, all while making it look effortless. Emails, phone calls, and urgent requests, no problem. They tackle them at the speed of light. Then there's the power of invincibility. not because they are hidden, because they work so seamlessly behind the scenes that makes everything work. Permits get filed, reports are ready, and the small details that make a big difference fall into place. Like any great superhero, they are always there, even when we don't see it. And let's not forget their X-ray vision. They can see straight through the most complex paperwork and processes, solving issues before they become problems. Their ability to interpret regulations, navigate the maze of procedures, and finding the best solutions are a superpower. Of course, every superhero has a big heart, and their compassion is their true strength. They are not just here to manage tasks, but to support their colleagues, lending a hand when needed. My pleasure to present Mrs. Haley Dodson with an award of excellence. He refuses to speak.
Well deserved. Well deserved. Thank you. Yeah, we're a very well deserved award, and we'll give Ms. Dodson a chance to speak when she takes roll on the votes, right?
And I had to order that in secret because she wouldn't have known about it, so it was a surprise to everybody.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Again, thank you, Ms. McElhaney, for the great presentations. I will go to public comment now, I think. Director Farmer.
I just want to make a brief comment, not so much about Haley, although we all know how hard Haley works and how much this district, you hesitate to say that, you know, somebody is like indispensable, but I think that that would probably relate to Haley. But who I'd really like to acknowledge right now, once again, is David Aguirre. Yeah, we certainly appreciate what Oscar is contributing with regard to resources, to facilities and resources. Thank you, Director Dean. But and I see that David has left. But David continues to do the best that he can. And he's got a shoulder injury that's going to require an operation at some point in the near future. And he's still out there working.
Yeah.
So it reminds me of an athlete that's playing with a serious injury for the good of the team, so to speak. And so I just want to acknowledge that for David, and I wish him all the best. Thank you.
Yeah, Director Farmer, that's very well said. I think with the staff at a lower level than it should be that in that particular department, he's pressed to a lot of things that would not normally be in a manager's manager's job, and he's holding, you know, he's doing an incredible amount of work. Mr. McElhaney may want to comment on that. We're trying as hard as we can to get all those positions filled, but right now he is doing work of a couple people probably.
Yeah, thank you, President Gray. We did bring on one more facilities and maintenance technician that was brought on actually this week.
Yeah.
We are holding interviews next week, so we should hopefully have F&R department fully staffed again within the next couple weeks.
Yeah. Thank you. Any other further comments? I'll turn it, I think, now to public comment. This is when people who are interested in a topic that is not on this agenda but is under the purview of this district can speak for up to 3 minutes. We have first of all, I'll ask for people from the floor. I think Mr. Hellman, right, is here? Yeah. Do you want to speak?
I came in here to find out, because a friend of mine who has had communication with the Coastal Commission is a bit upset that it seems like the board is, I don't know, I don't have all the information I would need to make definitive statements about exactly what's happening. So I came here to find out what exactly the board is doing, or Mr. Carmel, or whomever is responsible, is calling for all these past communications between Tina Dickerson and the Coastal Commission and all of that. Now, I'm friends with Tina, so I'm partially prejudiced in one side, so I can't be totally neutral here. But I hope this is not a case of a board getting criticized and then vindictively going after a whistleblower. That may not be the case at all. I don't have enough information to make any kind of statement like that. So I dropped by to make an inquiry, and the board is very receptive. I appreciate that. I like our board. And management is good. But on the surface, it just didn't seem right that this board is going after an individual who, as a layperson, has every right in the world, every right in the world, to scrutinize the behavior and actions of the board. There's too much of this going on in our political systems right now where anybody that makes a statement against somebody else is going to get threatened with lawsuits and all this kind of stuff. I really hope that's not happening here. I would like to get more information, if it's at all possible, on exactly what is going on with this investigation of the board. I hope it's not nefarious. I really hope that's not the case.
Yeah.
And perhaps it's not, but again, I think this ought to be, this information, ought to, exactly what the board is doing, should be presented to the public. Okay. Thank you for...
Thank you, yeah. And for the record, Jeff Hellman, right? Yes, sir. People, if they come up to the microphone, it'd be good if they just announced their name. And I sort of took care of it for you, but
when anonymity is one of your most important,
well, yes. It, technically you can be anonymous, but of course when you're, you know, in public place like
right.
This, it's hard to be anonymous.
That's a sacrifice some people make who have good intentions. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Care to comment, Mr. McElhenney? Yeah.
Could I comment first?
Vice President Scott.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. President. I just want to thank you for coming forward in person and saying what you just said. I really appreciate that you're attending our meeting and that you come with your concerns. So thank you, Mr. Hellman.
Democracy only thrives when there's a informed electorate.
Thank you. Yeah, Mr. McElhenney.
Thank you, President Gray. Some background on the public records request that did involve Mrs. Dickinson and another community member. It is more about the conversations that we are trying to get involved in with the Coastal Commission and some of their concerns about some of our projects that weren't being communicated with us. And so we were reaching out to the Coastal Commission for some comments on our project description or maybe the zero liquid discharge. And we weren't getting a lot of communication occurring, but we were having conversations with community members who are also engaged with the Coastal Commission. And there were conversations happening that we weren't aware of. And so to get into those conversations, we did do a public records request, but it was more for the communications on the Coastal Commission side, not the community member side. And so it was not nefarious in any way. It was just to get a clearer picture of what those communications are.
Yeah.
And to add to that, I've been having communications with the Coastal Commission because they submitted some responses to our project description, which I'm sure we'll talk about here in a second. And Mr. Lester was indicating some comments that the Coastal Commission had given staff, obviously years ago. We can't seem to locate those communications. They might be buried in some of staff's emails that no longer work here. And his response to us was, submit a public records request. Mm-hmm. So it's standard operating procedure when you're trying to get some more information on communications between agencies and the public.
Yeah.
So I can tell you 100% that it was not any targeting of community members.
Yeah, and I just like to add about the Public Records Act itself and its purpose. It is designed to shed light on the workings of public agencies, and a large, huge part of that is communications that public agencies have within their ranks with other agencies, but also with private citizens, inevitably, because they send out emails in response to emails and so forth. And the purpose of that, I mean, I've had to dump a couple of years of emails on a PRA request, and it's part of being in public interaction with public agencies. And communicating with them, it's a net that catches a lot of communications that people might think are private but are not, and it's just how it works. It's just how the system works, because you need to have information about what public agencies are doing and thinking and planning, and this is the method for doing it, basically. So thank you for bringing this up, and Dr. Thomas, yeah.
Yeah, and thank you very much, President Gray. And I just wanted to add regarding the question regarding is this in some way vindictive or punitive? And there's really a public records request has no punitive or vindictive impact on the parties involved. It's merely the gathering of information. In this case, a rather sincere and simple need for information.
Yeah. Thank you. Any other comments from people in attendance? Ms. Dodson, anyone by Zoom?
No.
Thank you. But for the record, there were two written comments that were submitted in, I think it was in this section, public comment. They're on the website, I don't know if anybody wants to discuss them or whatever. One is from regarding the new electric EV truck, and then was regarding the filing of the CDPP application with the county. I don't know if anybody wants to comment, either on the board or we've all seen them, or in the staff on these. You know? Mr. McElhinney?
I would be happy to answer. Is there some more specific questions about either or of the
If not,
public
we can move, if not, we can move on. Mr. Thomas, yeah.
Thank you, President.
Sometimes the chair has trouble seeing these lights. Yeah. That's the other problem. Yeah. Yeah, but go ahead.
These were thanks. Very thoughtful comments from Ms. Anita Miller. You know, essentially she's asking, for the life cycle cost of the EV Lightning pickup truck, and from Jim Townsend asking, in more depth regarding the CDP application. Both thoughtful questions that I'd like to hear the answers to, because I'm sure you have well thought out answers.
Absolutely. So I'll address the EV truck first. There were several questions about the price. It was $54,878.65, and that is the government rate. And I know Mrs. Miller was pulling MSRP prices off the website, which those can be significantly higher than our base model F-150 Lightning. So that was the cost there. There are some questions about cost involved in the charging station. We currently own and operate a level 2 charger. We haven't calculated how to charge ourselves for using the charger, but we're also working with the utilities is also working on a grant for more additional chargers at the wastewater plant. Another question about it was mileage driven in our small community, cost of fuel, diesel or gas versus the investment itself in the EV vehicle. I don't have those numbers, but intuitively, I know that it's going to be less expensive to operate our EV truck than it would be for our diesel vehicles or gas vehicles. And I'll let Mr. Green jump in here in a second. And then another question about our ability to charge it in case of a power outage. We have multiple generators within the district and multiple fueling stations with hundreds of gallons of fuel. So we could operate a generator, my guess is, probably for almost a week uninterrupted. So we wouldn't have any issues charging that vehicle. And then with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Green if he has anything to follow up.
Honestly, so CARB has...
President Gray, can I interrupt?
Yes.
We know that public comment is not an opportunity for a prolonged discussion. They're not agenda items. It's an opportunity for the public to comment. So just keep that in mind as we drag this along.
Okay.
Well, we can cut it short there.
If we want to, yes. Dr. Dean, though. I would
like just to point out, though, that we are required as we replace our vehicles to replace them with a certain percentage of electric vehicles.
Absolutely, yes. And then I know there was a comment about whether or not we – do you want me to address that?
Well, Mr. Carmel, I mean, there's another question that was raised in the written comment about whether we have truthfully said that we have submitted the application to the county for the CDP. I mean, the final full application. So I don't know if
I can address it pretty short and sweet if you like.
It depends on is it a matter of length or is it a matter of getting into, you know, discussions with people who aren't here?
It's both, but it's there is always an opportunity to respond briefly to public comment. As it develops into a discussion akin to an agenda item, that's prohibited under the Brown Act.
Okay. Thank you. That's duly noted. So a brief response is in order.
Okay, there's some question about whether or not we submitted the CDP application, as stated in my GM letter. We received a response September 10th from County of San Luis Obispo Department of Planning and Building. Specifically on that 10th, it acknowledged your application has been reviewed by the Department of Planning and Building, and that information is on the attached list and is required before it can be accepted as completed for processing. That was an information hold for an updated land use application, which has been completed and submitted. It is now in the review process and has been sent out to all the stakeholders for review. Okay. So an application has successfully been submitted.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions for Mr. McLean in this? Okay, good. So there are no other comments, I think, from people via Zoom or in the hall, so we'll move on to regular business. And I think our first item is a presentation of item 5A of the Stillwater Sciences on the in-stream flow study that's just been completed and submitted. Now, maybe we'll start with Mr. McLean, who's introducing it, or Mr. Green, and then we can introduce the presenters. I see one up there already.
Thank you, President Gray.
Yeah, we'll go from there.
Agenda item 5A, receive a presentation from Stillwater Sciences and file the in-stream flow study. There's no fiscal impact associated with this item. As we know, an in-stream flow study is an assessment of stream and stream flows and is associated aquatic habitat in Lower San Simeon Creek and the San Simeon Creek Lagoon. The study was expanded in 2023 to include Lower Van Gordon Creek. That was approximately mid-2023 where we added that scope. And we do have Mr. Gus Yates, Mr. Ken Jarrett, and Mr. Ethan Bell here to answer any questions.
Thank you.
And I will turn it over to our utilities manager, Mr. Green.
Mr. Green.
Hi, thanks. I'm sure you guys have reviewed this here. Again, this was kind of to supplement our CDP PD, our project description as well. There are some concerns from TAC and Coastal that were addressed in this flow study. And again, appreciate our presenters here to talk and answer any questions. So I guess I'll defer to you, and we can start, President, if you have questions or.
Okay, well, like to welcome our presenters from Stillwater Sciences, and whoever wants to start, introduce yourself, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Ethan Bell. I'm an aquatic ecologist with Stillwater Sciences. And the work that Stillwater conducted in the field work was led by Ken Jarrett, who's on the phone. Ken Jarrett's a fisheries biologist. And we also were working closely with Gus Yates, who conducted all of the groundwater assessments for our assessment.
Thank you.
And we have presented to the board, I believe, the results of the study previously, and we don't have a formal presentation today. We're available to answer any questions. Since the presentation that we've given previously and the reporting that we provided, we did do an additional assessment in Van Gordon Creek, and that's included in the latest version of our report, and it's also taken into account. And the recommendations that we provided to the board for operations, pumping operations that could be conducted that would be protective of steelhead, California red-legged frog in the watershed.
It sounds like we just want to take questions. Is there anything further in terms of just a presentation, or we'll just ask questions from the board and then the public? That's okay.
I think that'd be most appropriate from our perspective. We could provide you with a presentation again, but we have done that previously, and I just want to be judicious with everyone's time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I note that a presentation was done for the Resources and Infrastructure Committee, so this isn't the first time. It's the first time for all the board members to ask questions, though, which is, I think, constructive. Well, I'll open this to to members of the directors if they want to ask, have any questions on this study and its significance and its bottom line. Director Thomas.
Yeah, thank you, President Gray. And I was pausing because you know, questions I have are rather near the end of this this document. But if we go to page 205, and I'm sure everyone wants to flip pages, so I'll pause. Yeah, 205 of the agenda packet.
And you might want to note the page number of the study too.
Of course,
because they might, I don't know if they have the agenda packet there.
Yeah. So in this case, the page number is 3-9 because it's in attachment 3, which is the you know, the comments and responses from agencies. And comment 13, the comments from the county asking approval of land use permit for project within an ESHA shall not occur unless the applicant has done the following things, and it sounds like the items that are listed, the impact on sensitive habitat, and the comment on the next page, it sounds like those would be within the scope of the in-stream flow study. So I just wanted to understand, because up to this point the responses to all of the comments from Tom Luster et al. Had been, quite articulate and quite appropriate. I thought, made perfect sense. To me, this one I didn't understand. Why would the, assurance that we would have no negative impact on the sensitive habitat and such be outside the scope of the in-stream flow study?
What comment number was that?
Number 13.
13.
Yeah, so it's your attachment, page 3-9.
There are actually two of them that I think that are similar.
Yeah.
Well, the one above it
is about.
It, in fact, it clearly is outside the scope of the study.
This is from Shawnee Seong at the county. 13, yeah. And then, yeah. I think there was a similar one from Tom Luster, too.
Yeah. So we didn't do a formal ESHA evaluation for this study. That said, the results of this study would certainly be very helpful to anyone who was doing an ESHA finding. And so this was, strictly speaking, an assessment of the in-stream flow needs for sensitive species and a look at how pumping operations may or may not affect those, but the ESHA findings, the ESHA analysis would probably be more broad than that and would look at the sensitive habitats, maybe even upland terrestrial habitats that are identified in that area. And then there would be a determination probably that would be based not just on pumping, but truck traffic or any number of things. And so I'm sure this would be helpful for that, but this was not an ESHA analysis. Okay. And so that's why we just provided that response to this comment in the context of this report, that it wasn't what we were addressing in this report.
Okay. Yeah. So it's from what you're saying, I would summarize that differently, that the findings of this report will be helpful in determining that, but addresses merely a subset, but it's certainly not out of scope. To me, it's clearly within the scope. It merely does not address the entire scope of the question. So based on your answer, I still don't buy that the comment is outside the scope of the study. Clearly, it's true that the instrument flow study does not entirely address her comment, but
yeah, I think that's a fair use of the term scope. Yeah, it is related, certainly, and it would be helpful, but we don't have a complete response to that based on this work that was done. A response to that comment.
Thank you.
And I should, you know, and there's, you know, one other, but you, if you want to, you know, go on this, go ahead.
Dr. Dean.
Wouldn't this be more in line with what would be done in an environmental biological study rather than the in-stream flow study?
That's my question, too. My question isn't there the limits of the in-stream flow study are actually have, this in-stream flow study is about pumping. It's not so much part of the environmental review for the WRF project, the CDP, but it's independent of that in a way that it's about, because it's about current pumping practices and how they affect the environment of the habitat on the stream. Isn't that true?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Yeah. So yeah, the ESHA study would be more for the connected with the application, the CDP application, more broadly. I think.
Yes.
Perhaps.
Yeah, exactly.
You're reading the comment differently than it sounds like it's written. And I should ask, is will there be any further revisions to this, or is this just what it is?
I believe we're this is what it is, Director Thomas. However, okay. we have future work that is ongoing with SWCA. Mm-hmm. We're Mr. Green and I are in discussions with a biologist. We've had communications with the Coastal Commission about our current biological assessments and what they may like to see. So I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, team, that these questions that still need to be addressed that aren't covered in the scope of this document will be worked on in further assessments biologically, environmentally.
Mm. Okay. In the only other comment, then on the next page on comment 16, and this is, you know, quite trivial in comparison, but the in the response, you're just missing a word in there. The comments states, the has been revised to clarify the statement, and so you probably would want to know that you've left out the word report in that context.
Thank you. Yes, correct. You are correct. Thank you.
Dr. Farmer.
Thank you, President Gray. First off, gentlemen, I want to thank you for what I would say is, you know, very professional report, mostly fully detailed. I want to thank you for the work that you've done in the past with our district. So I'd like to ask you a couple of questions, and I'm thinking that even if I'm just moving into page like 10 and 11 right now, this is part of your report. By the way, before I forget, obviously you've done considerable work here in the county, and I know this isn't necessarily an ESHA analysis that you've done, but how often are you involved in studying or bringing information forward with regard to a particular project that is in an ESHA zone, especially a zone of this magnitude, a 92-acre ESHA zone? How often are you dealing with something like this?
Many, many of our projects are within sensitive habitats, including ESHA zones. So we're working in floodplains, you know, throughout the state, estuaries, lagoons, and other similar designated habitats throughout the state.
So I'd like to thank you very much. So I'd like to ask you a couple of questions here. First off, and I realize, let me just read this comment. This would be the beginning of paragraph 4, where it says, under CCSD's current emergency CDP, the WRF is allowed to operate only during declared 3 water shortages. So I'm just curious, also on page 11, where it says, sustained long-term use of the WRF during the dry season is being considered as part of the regular CDP application. So I'd be curious to know, with regard to sustained long-term use, dry season, how would these be defined? I mean, sustained long-term use is rather vague, and the dry season, I would say that's probably what, from early summer until fall or something like that. But how it would be interesting, it would be helpful to have something more specific than just these relatively general terms. Is what I'm saying make any sense? And also, by the way, with regard to only during declared stage three water shortage, nothing with regard to the initial emergency permit that we got. The permit allowed for only for existing customers only and not for growth. That might not necessarily be applicable to what you're writing here, but I'm just wanted to point out that that was in the original emergency permit that we received.
Any comment?
Yeah. That specific phrasing in those terms were was text that we received from the district, and so this was part of what we were evaluating. So we were instructed that the WRF could be used during the dry season, but that was being considered, and so we evaluated what that influence that might have on sensitive species. I don't know if that helps, but it wasn't an operation that we were describing with any judgment.
Mm-hmm. And Director Farmer, if you,
please, I'm sure Mr. McElhenney?
Mr. Green might be able to clarify what we were discussing there in terms of guidance with that section. To catch off guard.
This is about defining dry season and sustained long-term use of the WRF. What we mean by that, is that for a way to state the question?
Correct.
Yes. Okay.
So our dry seasons
beginning, which is basically May through October 31st each year. That's also when the diversion for Santa Rosa reduces to 155.3, and that's again from May 1st through October 31st, and that's mm-hmm. when we switch a lot of our pumping from the San Simeon well field to the Santa Rosas.
Okay, so let me just ask, sustained long-term use of the WRF during the dry season. So we've had dry seasons in the past, before the WRF was built, and since then, and there hasn't been a situation of such emergency that we would have needed to consider the use of the WRF. So what is sustained long-term use? Now, obviously, it depends on the circumstances, but I'm just curious as to, obviously, we'd be doing this under an emergency situation.
I guess
I just feel a bit frustrated with regard to sustained long-term use of the WRF when we haven't used it.
I think where we're going with that was, even in emergency operations, our operations shouldn't cause long-term impacts to the environment.
So our goal of the in-stream flow study, Director Farmer, would be to have that analyzed if we had to operate the WRF for a sustained period of time, and what effect would that have mm-hmm. on the stream? And so mm-hmm. that's what we're looking at. If we were to have to operate that facility for a sustained period, if we went back to 2016 was our big drought, is that correct? 13-14 was our largest drought. If we had to activate it and run it for a sustained period of time, what is that outlook? And that is what we had these gentlemen study and look at that as a part of the scope, if that makes sense.
Okay, so I don't want to hog the conversation here, which it appears that I'm doing. So let me just ask here, under page 57, key conclusions of this study. And they relate to CCSD pumping operations. So I'm assuming that this means normal day-to-day use, providing water to the community and not for the current residents, or does it also relate to the future use of the WRF?
I'll turn that over to the Stillwater, Stillwater people for a response.
Yeah, so what we're saying is that pumping could continue, whether that's for your current residents or future residents. We weren't addressing the nuance of who you're providing that water for, but rather how operations could be conducted, how pumping operations could be conducted that would be protective of Steelhead and California Red-Legged Frog, especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Any other questions from Director Farmer?
No, I think I should allow other people to comment, and maybe I'll come back. Thank you.
Vice President Scott, you have any questions? No, I had a couple questions. One is I think it's page. I have it clipped here, where you actually give. This is on page 180 of the agenda, and it's on the page seven of the attachment one, which is a recommendations memo. Actually, it's page six and seven. There is a list of conditions, stream flow conditions, and under recommendations under operations management. Oh, it's actually on the agenda, it's page 179 and 180. You give several conditions about, and this is our, this has to do with our current pumping. This is irrespective mm-hmm. of the WRF. Mm-hmm. You give recommendations for what we can do or should do when stream flow is at certain levels, cubic feet per second. And I noticed there's a zone of that flow in which we should not be pumping from the San Simeon aquifer. Can you give me some sense of when, in a typical year, or maybe atypical year, but let's say a typical year to start, how it suggests to me that there's like a month and a half or so in the late spring when we would have to shutting down the San Simeon pumps and say going to Santa Rosa. But is that fair to think in those terms of a schedule based on this?
Yeah, I think that is fair. That'd be definitely a fair consideration. So it's not based on a specific schedule, and we wouldn't recommend that you tie it to specific dates because, as you know, right. Every water year is so different. So in a lot of years, that sensitive period between 0 and 1 CFS would be the late spring, mm-hmm. and it might be something that would occur for 2 weeks or a month and during the late spring. But there's going to be water years where that's a really brief moment in time if it occurs at all. And there's other years where it would occur, that sensitive period again would occur during the fall, especially during lower water years. So, and it would be possible to look at the historical hydrograph and get a good sense of how often it occurs and when that would be. But yeah, it's going to be something that would be during the springtime, during the late spring and some years during fall.
And you're
for
saying,
that 0 to 1 CFS. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you're saying yeah. brief, I mean, how long you would, because it's a transition between high flow and low flow, and I don't know how long it takes, but do you have any sense of how long that lasts typically?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it could, that sensitive period could be weeks long in some years, but it's going to be, and in other years, it could be on the order of a week or several days. Ken, do you want to speak to that? Do you have a better sense on your review of the hydrograph and what that duration might look like?
Yeah, just based on the water data that we've reviewed, I would say I would anticipate a few weeks would be pretty standard for most years, and then wetter years it could be a little bit longer, or in dry years, it could be a little bit shorter.
Okay, thank you. My other question, it comes from the introduction, and it's sort of a broad one, but I mean, maybe if you want to address it, any of you want to address it, it'd be very helpful. It's stated in the introduction that findings from this study, this task one study, And the concurrent groundwater studies, task two, about the, I think Mr. Yates is conversant in, obviously, will be used to identify a sustainable amount of groundwater that can be extracted during the operation of the San Simeon groundwater wells and long-term operation of the Water Reclamation Facility, WRF. How far does this take us towards determining that amount of sustainable groundwater extraction, that magic number?
I can jump in on that if
sure.
you can, Ethan, if you want. That wasn't actually the assignment to see if there was a sustainable yield. What we did is for the groundwater modeling part, basically in the WRF operation part, is I took a certain district yield number, the amount of water that the district wanted to produce. I was using 700 acre feet per year at the time I did the analysis, and then looked to see whether operation of the WRF made it feasible to do that without violating one of the triggers. And it turns out it was feasible to do that. The critical constraint was consistently the gradient between SS2 and 9P2, the wells that are sort of below the well field and then in the wastewater percolation area. And with operation of the WRF, you can quite strongly influence that gradient. So that injected water from the WRF prevents a reverse gradient from occurring, and that allowed the 700 acre foot per year yield that I was evaluating to function. But I was not exploring other magnitudes of yield, but since the hydraulics of the WRF are quite favorable with respect to that constraint, I think it would be likely that the same conclusion would apply to, potentially lower and even higher numbers.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else want to comment on my questions? Director Thomas.
Yeah, thank you, President Gray. And I wanted you commented on this earlier, but I kind of jumped into the minor critiques. But it's really important to keep in mind the scope of this is, the CCSD commissioned Stillwater to give us an answer to the question, amount of stream flow that will support the key species and habitat in the lower San Simeon Creek. And that's all, so that those findings can be used to understand how we're going to operate. In this case, the board is not being asked to take action, but if we have concerns about the validity of the report, those need to come out here. You all know me, to go through a 210-page report, the only thing that I found that concerned me was on page 205, my disagreement about whether one comment was in scope or out of scope. In the big scheme of things, that's very trivial, more trivial the missing of one word. But from what I've seen going through this, I've got no concern about the technical validity of this. It's an excellent report and gives us great information that we can use, and the county and other entities can use to, provide a yay or nay on the permit. I've heard some critique about this. This document does not define how the CCSD will operate the water reclamation facility if and when we're out to operate that. That's coming from the project description. That's not part of the scope of this, so we wouldn't expect to see that reflected here. That's not part of this scope. So, thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you. Yeah, I want to make it clear that we're asking questions for clarification and to understand the report better. I'm certainly not intending to critique it, but my questions are to understand what the implications are and what we might take away stuff that's useful in our planning. I have one more question. Oh, Director Farmer.
Okay, and ask your question, then I'll go.
Oh, my question is this of Mr. Yates. This has to do with, now some of the things that we're dealing with here in this report are actually appendixes or attachments, but they're part of the report.
Yeah.
And the one that I wanted to ask Mr. Yates about was attachment 4, which is responses to the Clyde Warren comment letter. This would be page on the agenda. It's page 221. in particular? I mean, I had a more general question about it, but this is here because it's part of the package because there was a letter from a landowner, Clyde Warren, about his water rights to about 183.5 acre feet, I believe it is, of San Simeon Creek water, that in addition to additional rights upstream of water that there's a sort of, I guess it's contested in a way, in a complicated way. But this memo, though, is a response to that. And if Mr. Yates can just give me a bottom line summary of what our point is here, because it's a little bit complicated. There's something about the, especially on page 221 after underwater rights, it seems to indicate that this is he's overstating his case on water rights, but it also seems to have to do with the operation of the WROF. So maybe you could clarify that.
Okay. That water rights section I developed in sort of in collaboration with Tim Carmel and Nick Jacobs. I'm not an attorney, but we worked together on it because I understood the hydrogeology. And we think, you know, a couple of key points are we don't think this is fundamentally a water rights issue, given that Mr. Warren has an agreement and basically a contract with the district about how much water each can pump and how to resolve disputes. There were technical issues about whether his assertions regarding his pumping from underflow Van Gordon Creek were substantiated by the actual groundwater flow patterns. And it doesn't appear to me that the groundwater near his well, which is right next to the project supply well in the San Simeon Creek Valley, is actually pumping water that would be underflow Van Gordon Creek because of the direction in which groundwater flows there. So there was an issue there. And then earlier I pointed out that there just wasn't sort of evidence supporting the claim that pumping at well 9P7, your WRF supply well, was what had been causing water level fluctuations up at his wells in Van Gordon Creek Valley. Yeah. I don't know, did that answer the questions you wanted me to answer?
Yeah, thank you, that did. And it was a rather complicated question, but thank you. Does anybody on the board have any more questions? Director Farmer, your light is on.
Thank you, and I think somebody is home as well. So I just wanted to, this is on page 122, right there in the middle, where it says a WRF operation can compensate for failure to achieve water conservation goals at each water shortage stage, which obviously I would say probably implies, well, how well are members of the community, whether it's the residences or the businesses, being able to cut back on their water usage when circumstances become more problematic. So I just wanted to point out that I believe it was back in 2014, 2015, when the water dilemma, the drought dilemma, was as serious as it has ever been in our community. And we were fortunate enough to cut back on our water usage, we meaning the community, 38%, which was the third best of all areas in the state of California. And so I just wanted to, you know, point that out. And I also want to mention the fact that from my humble estimation, and I think a lot of people in the community feel this way, the WRF should only be operated in an emergency. And I would just leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you. If there are no further questions from the board, I'll turn this over to public comment. Anybody here in attendance want to comment on this report? Ms. Dodson, anyone via Zoom?
Yes, Christina Galloway.
Ms. Galloway.
Hi, Christina Galloway from Cambria here. I'm the environmental rep on the NCAC, and I just had a few questions. Mainly the key conclusions, they just landed to me as a layman as some of the wording was just really nonspecific, like the use of like not expected or likely to have little effect or do not appear to impact. And so I'm just wondering, like, in your experience, is that typical wording for key conclusions, or is there something about this project that, you know, kind of has these key conclusions as landing a little bit vague?
Yeah, thanks, Christina. Appreciate that question. I think it's a fair one. So this in this type of biological sciences evaluation, you know, we're collecting data as best we can to infer and try to get our best sense or, you know, understanding of the system. But it's not a precise science like physics or astronomy. So it's very typical that we don't overstate our conclusions. We try not to get out over our skis. So we definitely say the pumping operations are not expected to influence, because they're not expected based on the data that we've collected and the evaluations that we've done and our observations. The other way we would do it is if every sentence had to be ultra, ultra conclusive, like pumping operations absolutely do not affect under any circumstances, we would have to collect a lot more data and have a lot more years, and we would just keep collecting data and data and data to make these really certain statements. And typically in the work that we do, there isn't time or budget, and it's not useful to the process to take that approach. And so instead, we collect the best data that we can with the time and the, you know, the resources that are available to make the best conclusions that we can based on that and not overstate them. And then also to make recommendations about what type of data you could collect moving forward that would over time increase the certainty of those conclusions. And so that's what we've done here. We've made conclusions on these. To me, these feel really familiar. These are the type of, you know, the type of conclusions that we would make in a study like this. And then we also have suggested the type of data that you might continue to collect over time that would over time either A, increase the certainty of these conclusions, or B, maybe find additional information that started to question some of these conclusions, which of course we'd be open to. So, does that help?
I think that's a good answer. Ms. Galloway, do you have anything else to comment on? Okay.
Hi.
Oh, hi.
Oh, sorry, I was muted. Thank you. No, that's really helpful. The only other thing that I had here was just in terms of this study, I know we've been throwing around the term sustained long-term use. If you could just clarify kind of what that means through your interpretation, that would be helpful. And that would be it for me.
Yeah, so that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I think that question was the one that Director Farmer was asking too. I think we, unless it's, I don't, it doesn't, it's not the same question pretty much, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. So I think that it was a term, that's a term actually that came from the CCSD in their inputs to it. So it's not really for slow water sciences to answer, I guess. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Galloway. Anybody else on Zoom? Okay, thank you. Well, I guess, you know, this report is being received. It's not an action item. We no action to take. I really appreciate, Director Dean.
I just want to thank Stillwater for all the effort they put in such a long, thorough report, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. And Director Farmer, your light is on.
I'll just concur with that. I just want to say we've had some anticipated reports that seem to take much longer than anticipated. And so I want to thank Stillwater for the work that they've done as well. And Mr. Yates.
Yes. Dr. Thomas.
Yeah, thank you. Just echoing, well-organized, you know, easy to turn to the conclusions, easy to go back to the methodology to understand what came back. Easy to flip from there to the appendices and go deeper. So I have no idea how many more times I will be flipping through this, but you know, this is one of those where I tabbed every section because this is kind of key for our future. So thank you for this landmark report.
Yeah, I think the term, I would say the term landmark is really apropos here because there's been discussion and debate and arguments over for decades over whether we are negatively impacting the habitat, particularly steelhead habitat in San Simeon Creek. But up till now, nothing as nearly as methodical, thorough, and professional as this has been done. So this is a real, this is the first time when I think some serious, you know, focused scientific effort has been directed at that question that has kind of bedeviled us for decades. So yes, your work is greatly appreciated, and I found it actually very readable, and I liked it. I found it very clear. So thank you again. Well, thank you for.
I have one.
Vice President Scott.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. President. So I'm not so worried about the goby, the steelhead, and the frogs anymore. So thank you.
Well, we really appreciate the opportunity to work closely with you all and to work closely in the watershed. We all are, you know, locally based, and so just to be able to make a contribution is very satisfying. So thank you all for that support. Thank you.
And thank you. And thank you for being here at the meeting and to answer questions.
Good. Anytime.
Yeah. Director Farmer is light on still.
I just want to make the comment, and we tend to lose sight, in our materialistic society, we tend to lose sight of the fact that, you know, our first obligation is to our mother, Mother Earth, and endeavoring to live in harmony with her as best we can, because we couldn't survive without Mother Nature. She can survive without us. And so, like I say, our obligation, especially in this beautiful community that we live in, is to do the best we can to address the needs of the creatures that have no voice. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Farmer. I'll move on now to item 5B, which is to receive, review, and file the watershed summary survey, sanitary survey, I'm sorry. Will Mr. McElhinney take over from here?
Thank you, President Greg. I'll kick it off, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Green for any clarification. Agenda item 5B, receive, review, and file the watershed sanitary survey. There's no fiscal impact associated with this item. The objective of this comprehensive survey was to provide an update to the district and about the district's water source system, describe our environmental conditions within the watershed, identify potential future sources of contamination in our watershed, provide water quality and watershed condition assessment, and describe our watershed control and management practices. It's a very comprehensive document. Staff does recognize there's a few minor changes that not only do we make an R&I, but we saw a couple more after extended look at it. Also meeting with our individual meetings with the directors, there's some other things that were identified that we might need to tweak a little bit and finalize. Okay. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Green for any further clarification.
Thank you, Mr. Green.
Good afternoon. Yeah, thanks. So this is indeed just what the name is. It's the watershed analysis. Basically, we're looking at our sources and the vulnerability of those sources and what would impact those sources. There's some other language and narrative in here that we kind of paint with a broad brush. This isn't, you know, going to be released through Hearst Media or anything. The intended demographic for this is the engineers at Division of Drinking Water. This is the fourth installment of a sanitary survey that I put out here for the district. This is the first watershed sanitary survey, and I really appreciate the work that Confluence Engineering and Dan Heimel and his team did putting this together. I think, again, concentrating on the watershed portion of this, it's really articulate. And, again, what I derived from some of this is we'd like to do some public outreach, perhaps at Farmers Market, next summer, the year upcoming, where we can kind of speak to taking care of, like Director Farmer said, you know, Mother Earth here, how to keep our impacts away from our stream beds and our watersheds and make it a lot less vulnerable. And that includes our municipal pumping and so forth. So with that, I had scheduled the creator of this, Dan Heimel, with it. And I'm not sure if he's on board with it.
He's there.
Or not. Like to ask some questions specifically, Dan's not really here to present, kind of like Stillwater. He's just here to answer some questions. Yeah. So, dear board, whatever you have, please direct it at Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you for showing, Dan.
I'll bring this back to the board. And anybody have any questions of Mr. Heimel? And thank you for being here, Mr. Heimel.
My pleasure. Okay.
Director Thomas.
Yeah, since you look my way, I thought I'd
put the light on. A great read, and really informative. And of course, going through this, then I have to put the urban water management plan on the screen, side by side, you kind of go through them together. There's so much information. A few questions on right on page one, page 230 of the agenda packet, where it says, this report serves as an update to the 2015 watershed sanitary survey, which was preceded by a statement that says we're required to update this every 5 years. Just wanted to ask, did we miss one?
Yes. Yes, okay. We did.
Yeah. Fair enough. Moving on, page three of the report references the Santa Rosa Creek Watershed Management Plan, and I searched for that on our website, and I think I found something on green space. Is that the Green Space 2010 report that we're referring to there?
Yes, I believe that is the report that's being referred to, and I believe it's included in the references component of the watershed sanitary survey.
Okay, just wanted to clarify. I thought so. And then on page four, I was kind of surprised to see the discussion about outreach, where it says, in addition to the district, local organizations, Green Space, FFRP, the Friends of Fiscal Energy Preserve, and the Cambria Forest Committee continuing their educational efforts, begs the question, how and to what extent are those efforts being coordinated? Because those could work together towards great benefit to the community, or everybody could keep working in their own silos and probably have very little impact. So kind of curious there. I guess that's more of a utilities question.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, so I haven't put anything formal together yet, but we've done some initial reaching out to some agencies or, some 5031Cs to see if they'd like to come and present and, do some public outreach with us and raise some more awareness.
Awesome. So it just makes a note to me to keep this in mind when we come to the strategic planning session, mm-hmm. And bring this up, because this could be a great goal. Mm-hmm. So page seven of the report, right below the table, San Simeon Valley groundwater basin wells are chlorinated at a common point. I had a great tour from Mr. Meeks. I had the impression that each of the wells was chlorinated just downstream of the wellhead pump. So can we clarify that?
So I'll clarify for that. Yeah. It's not downstream. It's about 4 feet away from the pump wellhead, and that's where they're chlorinated. They have one general location where each of those wellheads gets analyzed for disinfectant residual. So again, we're kind of painting with a broad brush here.
Yeah.
Division of Drinking Water is the recipient of this. They have down to the very nitty-gritty detail of our process flow, our gallons per minute, where each of our disinfection injections are located. So again, we're just kind of touching on this and getting more to the specificity of our watershed.
Gotcha. So in this context, the fence that's around all three of those wells in the greater facility is what you're talking about.
Correct.
Fair enough. Also on page seven, as I read, the MTBE plume was deemed stable by the district. Just trying to understand what stable means.
Non-detect. And that's in the raw water. That's not treated water. That's raw water source in SR3 and SR4.
Great.
We've been sampling quarterly for the entirety of this year, and we've had zero detections.
Yeah, because I love non-detect. I love gone. But stable to means there could be tons of it, and it's just not moving. So stable scared me. Right. So thank you. Mm-hmm. Uh, couple of comments are trivial. I've communicated those already. Moving ahead to page 9. You know me, I did the math, I compare, I just, and looking at the project description, the data, I certainly got numbers that didn't match the numbers in here, so maybe talk offline. And then moving ahead to page 14, and this statement, where it says the second period, about a third of the way down, the moratorium may be lifted as soon as 2026, is, it sounds like we're paraphrasing the urban water management plan. So I look, the urban water management plan states, for the purposes of future water planning in the UWMP, it's assumed that new service connections will not be allowed until 2026. So it's pretty clear in the urban water management plan is that we're pretty sure we're not going to get there until after 2026, and likely long after. The wording here sounds like, all right, folks, 2026, get ready to build. So that is a different sense, and I would encourage that we reframe that.
So they're two totally different documents. Again, we're painting with a broad brush here. Uh-huh. And should we actually achieve that ability to operate and let's assume a 1% growth as soon as 2026 or end of 2025, we needed to put that in there because, again, it's a source water supply impact. Mm-hmm. While that 1% are those 40 houses that could potentially be released, that would be an impact from our source, correct? So again, two different documents, and again, we're just kind of painting with a broad brush here. This isn't specific as our CDP PD. Again, we're just trying to address potential impacts and paint with a broad brush again for the impact from our source.
Sure. Thank you. It's a big difference to say, we're pretty sure we're not going to be a different context. Yeah, I'm sure we won't be ready to go out until at least 5 o'clock tonight. Versus, we might ready to go. We might be ready to go going out by five. It's a different. It's framed positively in the opposite direction. It just sounds like we're inferring a different outcome.
Okay. Any other questions?
No, that's
okay. Okay.
That's it.
Director Dean.
Okay, I want to say thank you. It looks like you addressed pretty much everything that we asked, that we pointed out during R&I, with the exception of two things. And on the same page that Director Thomas was just talking about, we needed to correct the number of waitlist positions. The last time I checked, it was 656, and I think there's been a couple that were retired since then. And that's under anticipated growth. Mm-hmm. On page 14 of the report, or 243 of the agenda. No longer 665. Last time I checked, it was 656.
I'll connect with Director Dean. I'll connect with Mr. Reaper, who will get an updated count, and we can make that edit.
Okay.
I believe Ms. Dotson and I corrected that. We checked in with Tristan. There had been two withdrawals, so the number that's on there should have been as correct as 2 weeks ago.
It's worth noting, when you look at the version in PDF, there's a comment in there. It looks like there's an intended correction that hasn't been made.
Okay, but it's not in here.
But it's not here.
This is the one we're adopting, or we're just receiving. Any other, Director Dean?
The other thing was... that I requested, but I wasn't expecting to happen necessarily, was the map on page 6 of the report. And I think I mentioned that it would be helpful for me if just as in the appendixes, Highway 1 and 46 were on that map, so I can kind of have a relationship of where everything is, since I have no sense of direction or anything.
Any other questions, Director Dean?
That was pretty minor. Okay, thank you.
Director Farmer.
Wow. No sense of direction or anything? Oh, okay. Thank you. I didn't know what that anything meant. So getting back to page 243, under anticipated growth, and this isn't necessarily directed at the gentleman up there,
Mr. Heimel.
But I just want to read what it says here. So indulge me. Anticipated growth at 2.3.2. The district has had a water connection moratorium in place since November of 2001. I think that's as much due to the county and the Coastal Commission. We didn't necessarily put that moratorium in place. I just want to mention that. Due to concerns over long-term reliability of its water supply and a need to increase water storage for fire suppression, to address these issues, the district conducted comprehensive water master planning studies, culminating in the certification of a program-level water master plan environmental impact report by the district's board of directors in August 2008. The PEIR, the environmental impact report, recommends a build-out of 4,650 existing and future residences. This will allow the 665 single-family, 7 multifamily, and 10 commercial lawn owners on the existing water connection list to proceed with connections over a period of 22 years once the moratorium is lifted, and the moratorium may be lifted as soon as 2026. So I'm just curious, what is going to change from 2001 when we had this water moratorium in place? We don't have any additional water. Everything has pretty much remained the same. So why should we be anticipating, despite the particular study that we had recently that says, well, we can just build out until 2045? I'd like to know, what should we anticipate changing that will allow the addition of 660 homes, which I assume means at least 1,500 people in this community?
Again, this is a five-year forecast, so we're just illustrating the potential.
Yeah, I'd like to interject something here about the scope of the questioning. This is a document that's about the safety of our watershed, and it's a lot of this material was plugged in, as it were, but this is not. We're not really asking for any, this is not our urban water management plan, first of all, which is more specific to these things. So we should keep the questions, I think, to the focus and the thrust of this document, which is on the watershed. Because I see a couple other things that are corrections. I'm not going to get into discussion, but we got to keep things focused on what this is actually about.
I totally understand
that.
But it was in there. So if I can just... I wanted to mention one more brief thing with regard to on page 249, urban runoff, the last paragraph. And once again, this isn't necessarily pertinent to the topic at hand, but the California Department of Transportation, Caltrans, uses herbicide products to limit plant and weed growth along highways. So the reason I brought this up and bringing this up is because I can remember when I first moved here, which is back, it'll be 38 years this coming November 1st, which kind of mind-boggling just on the face of it. And I can recall, since I've lived almost the majority of the time on Lodge Hill, coming down Ardeth, making a right onto Highway 1, and especially in the springtime, the abundance of lupin and poppy that would be there, so visual and so visible and just so heartwarming and so nurturing to the soul and spirit. And then one day, as it says here, Caltrans sprays herbicides along these sections of the highway to kill broadleaf weeds and cracks and around hardware and so forth. However, just let me finish. I recall seeing them spraying one day, and those lupin and poppies never came back.
No.
And I realize I'm off the topic. I just wanted to point that out.
You're off as chair.
Because it's like, it was really discouraging.
As chair, I do have to kind of like caution you that you're off topic on that one. I think that's, we have to say, you know, I have a couple of questions that hopefully are on topic. Does anybody have any more questions? Vice President Scott, you had one? Yeah.
I turned my light on and then off, and now it's on again. Because I just want to say, thank goodness you had this report done, even if it's 4 years late.
Yeah. My question is, did we have to pay any sort of penalty for being late?
No, it's kind of similar to our tank dives, which are scheduled every 5 years. Mm-hmm. It's rather a suggestion from the Division of Drinking Water. Yeah, they'd like you to keep that mm-hmm. rigid plan. But we experienced difficulty even finding a biologist. And thank goodness for Dan Heimel and his team,
yeah.
who did a wonderful job on this. But yeah, there's no notice of violation. There's no punitive penalty for this.
That's good.
For being late.
Yeah.
And since about the year six, so a year overdue mark here on this, I'd been working with Jeff Dinsmore in the Division of Drinking Water, updating him on the status mm-hmm. and the progress of this.
Yeah.
So they were fully aware of, you know, our progress or our lack of progress at that time. And where we are going with this. So they've been in the loop the whole time. And, so that's been completely transparent with that agency.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and I had a question or kind of a correction and a question. But on the page 42, under sanitary survey recommendations and conclusions, there are 611 under operational data, a couple of things. Confuse me. The first paragraph says the district has very limited operational data for the filter systems on SR3 and SR4, as they have been operated very little since installation. But hasn't that filtration system on SR4 especially been operated all along?
So we only have SCADA, which we've developed a redundant uh-huh. server, so that way it keeps all of our data for indefinite period of time. So that's only been installed for 4 years.
Okay.
So that's all the like historical data that's actually
in other words, it had been there for a long time. You don't have the
right.
data from it. Okay. Yeah. And the next paragraph, the WRF has not been operated since installation. Now that reflects an error and on page, I believe it is earlier on where it's. It stated that the WRF, then the EWS, this is page 9, was never actually operated. And, of course, it was operated over a period of a couple of years in three stretches. And that probably needs to be revisited, that paragraph, because the stage three declaration that allowed its operation wasn't rescinded until, I think, about 2017, March of 2017. March of 2017. But that bears on this sentence in the operational data recommendation. If a district can obtain proper permitting, it would be beneficial to collect water quality data on the source water, treated recycled water, and RO concentrate. Isn't there some data, though, from when we did operate it that might be still in existence?
For the WRF?
Yeah,
yes,
WRF,
absolutely,
back in operational period.
We have that.
That would be helpful, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That, on its inception, had SCADA mm-hmm. and a redundant receiver that maintained all that data.
Okay, yeah. And I had a real quick question for Mr. Heimel. These recommendations are fairly broad brush, obviously. Is there any risk factor or contaminant threat or anything regarding our groundwater that we have to pay particular attention to that might be a particular problem going forward, you know, among all the other things we're just monitoring?
Yeah, I mean, in our analysis and research putting this together, I mean, our assessment, you know, is that the district is, you know, doing a good job in monitoring the source waters for its water system. I mean, could there be more monitoring? Yes, always. But, you know, it's a cost benefit analysis. I mean, one of the things I think really works in the district's favor is the relatively limited number of threats within its watershed. You know, I think the district has in an enviable position to have, a relatively low level of an industrial commercial threat within the watershed. That being said, could there be threats? Potentially. I think some of the, what jumped out at me potentially was, there are some of the old abandoned mines in the watershed could pose a threat, but, based on the review of the data that we had, and the district's operational data, there hasn't been any observance of any water quality or contamination issues. But I guess I would recommend just the continued diligence for monitoring for the potential contamination.
Thank you very much. There are no further questions from the board. I'll turn this over to public comment. Anybody in attendance here wish to comment on this report, this item? Anyway, by Zoom?
No.
Okay, thank you. I guess we will duly, I think we can, I don't know if it takes a vote, we're simply receiving the report, right? So it doesn't need an action. Yeah, thank you.
I just wanted to thank.
Yeah, Mr. Heimel, thank you for coming, yeah, and sitting and answering the questions we had for you, because you were very helpful for me in particular. I think we're ready to go ahead with the next item.
Yeah, just thank you,
everybody.
Those thanks. There's information here, a great deal, yeah, that we haven't seen anywhere. So this is really useful.
So item 5C, we'll take this one up and maybe take a short break afterwards. I think that should be appropriate.
Thank you, President Gray. Agenda item 5C, yeah. Discussion and consideration of approval of a public works contract with Alpha Electrical Service for construction of the Rodeo Grounds Pump Station Backup Power System Replacement Project and authorization for the general manager to execute the agreement. The fiscal impact, there's $155,000 budgeted for procurement and installation of this new backup power system. The bid from Alpha Electric is for $136,692.89. And with that, I'll turn it over for Mr. Green for clarification.
Mr. Green.
All right, very good. We have an over 30-year-old generator, tier zero, not very efficient, very loud, but it's been very beneficial to us. It's at the heart of our system, which is Rodeo Grounds. That's one of our main pumping stations. From there, obviously, we pump up to Stewart Street, to Lodge Hill, and then all the way up to Top of the World to our Fiscalini tank. So we can't get it to those two locations without that booster station. There's also backup power for the F&R shop and for the treatment wellhead that is SR3. It's gotten to the point now where this old generator is obsolete. We can't get parts. To get parts to repair this, they have to be fabricated. So we're right now looking at a $10,000 fabrication fee to make this thing run for an undetermined amount of time. And we're not even sure if that $10,000 fabrication would actually work in this. So we need to replace this and do something responsible and put a tier four generator in. We had three contractors come to the site and kind of do a site inspection. We received two physical proposals for this. And so we're taking the least expensive, and this is about $40,000 south of our other bid. So we're taking Alpha's bid, and they have a ton of institutional knowledge with our water and wastewater departments. They've done work for us for over 10 years, and I'm pleased to see that he was the most affordable bid, and we look forward to getting this replaced and having this installed.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions from the board? And Dr. Thomas.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment, and I looked at the engineer's estimate, and I asked Mr. McElhaney, you look at that, and, the engineer's estimate of $125,000 on page 303, that's within 10%. From my experience, that's really good estimating. Yeah, we've got extensive experience with Alpha Electric, so...
We do in our experience to further that, thank you, Director Thomas, is he comes in on budget or under budget because he does his due diligence in site inspection and planning and engineering estimates. And he also executes on a timeline that's either before or right on time. So there's some other benefits to using Alpha Electrical.
Yeah. Any other? Dr. Farmer.
I just want to make a comment. I think most people in this community, including maybe even members of the board, aren't aware of what you just described, Mr. Green, just a short time ago, with regard to the pumping station and pumping water up to the Stewart Street tanks and pumping it up to Fiscalini, which is way up beyond the end of Pine Ridge. And the fact that this has to happen 24/7, 365, it's amazing that we have as few problems as we have with regard to providing water to the community, especially the folks on Lodge Hill.
Amen to that. You're right. With that aging infrastructure, as far as that generator there, yeah, we've been very fortunate that we haven't, you know, experienced more interruptions in service from the device. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Vice President Scott.
I have a motion.
Well, I have a public comment.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, if no further questions from the board, I'd like to open this to public comment. Anyone in attendance want to comment on this item? Anyone on Zoom?
No.
Yeah, thanks. There being no public comment, I'll return to the board for a discussion and a motion. I think Vice President Scott, you're up.
Okay. I move that we approve the public works contract with Alpha Electrical Service for construction of the Rodeo Grounds Pump Station Backup Power System Replacement Project and authorize the general manager to execute the agreement.
And do I hear a second?
I'll second it.
Okay.
And if I could just make one additional comment.
Sure.
I'm sorry. With regard to what I just stated to Mr. Green, one of the reasons that we can be really grateful is because of the staff that we have that stays on top of everything. So, yeah. With regard to the pumping of the water, thank you.
Well said. It's been moved and seconded that we approve a public works contract with Alpha Electrical Service for construction of the Rodeo Grounds Pump Station Backup Power System Replacement Project and authorization for the general manager to execute the agreement. Ms. Dodson.
Vice President Scott?
Aye.
Director Dean?
Aye, and I agree with Director Farmer's statement.
Director Thomas?
Aye.
Director Farmer?
Aye.
President Gray?
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Let's take a 10-minute break, unless you, Dr. Farmer, you have anything else?
Yeah,
I
just want to make one comment. I just want to ask one question that I had written down here, and I overlooked it. Mr. Green, how long do we anticipate this particular project taking?
Unfortunately, the generators, like most of generators that size, is a 30-week lead time. So we'll be literally emailing Alpha right now, knowing that he can proceed with the procurement of that, but we are 30 weeks out.
Okay, so that's like 7-8 months, give or take.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. We take a break till 2:50. Welcome back. We're ready to go for the remainder of our regular board meeting. We're at item 5D on of regular business. This is discussion and consideration regarding directing the policy committee to develop a policy for streetlights and lights at other facilities under CCSD's jurisdiction. So, Mr. McElhaney, you can take it from here.
Thank you, President Gray. As stated, Agenda 5D is a discussion and consideration regarding directing the policy committee to develop a policy for streetlights and lights at other facilities under our jurisdiction. And I think it'd be most appropriate to turn it over to Vice President Scott.
Yes.
She's been working closely with the policy committee on these topics.
And Vice President Scott.
Yes, thank you. The policy committee was given the assignment to look at the CCSD policy handbook contents and see where there may be things that we would need to address by another policy. And because there was not the information there about lighting and about how we go about making decisions about lighting, the policy committee is recommending that you allow us to go ahead and create a policy regarding the lights that are under the jurisdiction of CCSD. In addition, this policy very much would involve, I think, finance and also R&I. So I would like not only direction for the policy committee to initiate the policy, but to work closely with those two other committees, because I think those are two important parts of what we would need to look at.
Thank you. Any questions for Vice President Scott?
You want questions now, discussion later.
Oh, questions now, yeah. Questions up front. Well, yep, the question I have is, when we say a policy for street lighting, for a street light installation and maintenance, and also other lighting, I guess purpose is the question I'm wondering about. What is the goal of the policy? Is it to make lighting more efficient? Is it for dark sky? What is the overall mission, I guess, of making a policy?
I think that's part of the discussion, but I think the answer to yes is it may be dark skies, it may be light
efficiency or
light efficiency, but also pollution, light pollution and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And how can CCSD, that which we have jurisdiction over, how can we be within the parameters that will enhance Cambria?
I have a question. I think this is maybe more for staff about, but maybe if Vice President Scott has information too, and also for benefit of me and the public, we don't have jurisdiction over all public lighting in Cambria or all street lighting. So maybe that can be, you can explain that a little bit, what we do have jurisdiction over and what we don't. If you have information at hand.
President Gray, I could just answer sort of in a global way. We really, our only jurisdiction is currently over our properties and our facilities.
Right.
Now, if the county adopted dark skies in Cambria, and I'd have to consult with Mr. Carmel, but I think the county would then regulate how those lights and work with us on how those lights that have been deemed to comply with dark skies. And I think that would be a county issue, much like our fire protection issues with developed parcels and things of that nature. So our real jurisdiction, and I'll let Mr. Carmel correct me if I'm wrong, is only over our facilities. Right. So if we were to adopt a policy, it would be how are we going to address our lighting at our facilities, and are we doing that in phases? How are we budgeting for it? Things of that nature.
Yeah. Isn't there some street lighting that we own, though?
23 of
them. Yeah. Like on Main Street? Mr. Carmel, I don't know if you have the numbers on that, but some of it we actually own too. Some lights we own, some like PG&E owns, I think.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And it is a county issue, generally speaking, except for the facilities we own.
Thank you. Yeah. So I don't have any further questions. I mean, if anyone else does, we can turn this over to public comment if there is any. Director
question.
Dean?
I have a question. Since this is over CCSD properties and facilities, wouldn't this be more finance and F&R?
That's what I just said. We need to definitely.
Oh, yeah, I thought you said R&I.
Oh, I meant.
Okay, because
I'm sorry.
I think that's kind of the confusion there is that F&R is the departmental on
right.
staff. F&R has to be the key.
There's
the key people.
Be a lot of people that we need to really work with to make right. this make
yeah.
sense.
I think F&R would be the primary. Contact with staff, and finance would have some role in the costs involved, but I don't think it's a major thing for finance, but it's definitely for F&R.
Yeah.
Obviously, yeah.
Again, I have comments, but they'll be.
Oh, okay. I'll do public comment. Go to public comment now, Mr. Dujic.
Dennis Dujic, Cambria residents. And I apologize for the Cambria versus Cambria, just was brought up that way. But I would like to reinforce what others have said. The inefficient and inappropriate use of lighting is in fact a pollutant, and it is wasteful and environmentally impactful. So I think it's incumbent on CCSD to do exactly what you're talking about doing. And coordinate with all the folks that need to be coordinated, including Beautify Cambria and any of the other organizations. You'll notice Beautify Cambria has dark skies on their website.
Yes.
And, I think it's appropriate for CCSD to have Dark Skies on its website and links to appropriate resources for organizations and for our customers, you know, our commercial customers especially. You know, going around, you can see, you know, many locations have these lovely but wasteful big bulb lights, you know, that just are really not effectively lighting, can be much more efficient, and they eliminate the dark sky potential. And I was just out last night looking at the Milky Way, and it's something that we all ought to be able to treasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other public comment? Mr. Howell.
Thank you, Don Howell, Cambria. Very, very briefly, I think that the as the reasoning is laid out in the agenda packet by the general manager, I think really covers it very well. The fact, and it's the absence of a policy is really the issue, and that anyone who is changing light bulbs or ordering lights, there is really no guidance other than budgetary at mm-hmm. this point. The other thing is, this is a chance for the district to do something in general about the light pollution and overuse of energy that can be actually done with relatively little expense. The committee itself draws no salary, and yet if they can come up with some good guidelines, then really the expense is just you folks having to adjust that and approve of it. So yeah, I highly urge you to do this. I think it's
okay. Thank you very much.
Low-hanging fruit, I think.
Yeah.
Thank you. Anyone else on Zoom?
No.
Okay, thank you. I'll bring this back to the board for discussion. Dr. Thomas.
Yeah, thank you, President Gray. And yeah, my comments are really right in line with what Vice President Scott was saying. And as I thought through this, my immediate reaction was, of course, right, have the policy committee create a policy. And I kick back and I think, like, streetlights. We you know, it's 23, as I understand, CCSD streetlights. We have CCSD facilities, and they have lights on them, and this is infrastructure. Yeah, I'll bet you know, Director Dean and her team would want to weigh in, and they have an licensed electrician on the team. Wow, and absolutely, finance. This has a big impact. If we choose to, you know, create a policy that says, you know, change out all of the street lights towards a certain direction, what's that going to cost? Holy smokes. How long, you know, what's the time frame? Boy, finance needs to weigh in. And I can't tell you how many times the question has come to the PROS committee on what direction will those lights be on the restroom and what's going to be in the community park. And I get to thinking, you know, and it's a policy, and I get to thinking, can't we create a citizens' action team? Can't we here, as the board, say, let's get you know, someone from each of these committees to work together? Because to me, it doesn't sound like purely a policy kind of policy. This is knee-deep operational, but they're looking for strategy guidance within this, and it's not operational, but it's knee-deep operational. And so it you know, it seems like an opportunity to do something a little different. So, you know, is that something that we could consider?
Any comment? Vice President Scott?
Yeah. No, I'm open to any kind of suggestions that anyone might.
Dr. Farmer.
Well, I just want to say, I think right here under discussion, the last line where it says, enhance public safety and support community well-being. Any example that we can set with regard to our lighting policy that would affect that, I think it should definitely be addressed. No doubt about it. If I could just say one more thing.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
It's on topic and slightly off topic, but so at times we see people have their lights on all night, including people that don't live here, but for some strange reason think they should have their door light on or garage light on or something. I have never heard anybody all the years I've lived here, said, gee, I sure wish more people had their lights on at night. It's usually, why does that person have their light on? There's no reason for it. So anything that we could do to address that issue in the most, how could we say it, the most environmentally and humanly advantageous way, we should make an effort to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Vice President Scott.
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. And I mean, for instance, the fact that we now have an electric truck. I mean, I think anything we can do to really be part and show an example for the community is really important.
Yeah, I was thinking not to make it too complicated, though, because we have a limited number of lights that we can limited amount of lighting that we actually control own. I think we could, narrow this down to the, basically what, I mean, Director Farmer was just reading the, that sentence there. For our part, I think we should have guidelines for this, for operations, basically aimed at maximum, you have to balance a little bit, but security, safety, efficiency, and, of course, prevention of light pollution. Absolutely. For our lights. Basically, I think it's fairly simple. I don't think we need – if you get a lot of – the problem, I think, with getting a lot of community involvement in this is that you're going to have to explain to people – and I'm not saying people are yet naive, but you're going to have to explain to them that most of the light pollution here does not come from CCSD or even from streetlights. It's a headache. I hate it, too, when people leave lights on all night and businesses have lights on, less so actually, but mostly residences. We can do what we can do, so we don't want to make it, but I don't think we should make it too complicated. Say, for our part, we'll do this. We'll have this, certain kinds of, we use the LED lights,
yep.
Keeping a certain frequency,
yep.
Keep them warm, not keep them yellow,
yeah.
That sort of thing. Shelter, have lighting fixtures that don't cast light in the sky, around, and have lights on only when it's needed for safety and security.
Yep.
I think that's a good, obviously going into more detail about it.
Yeah.
It'd be good as part of this to take an inventory of what we actually have in the way of lighting, what our lights are. So start from that and what we can do, and then have a policy that, basically guidelines for how we light, how we do our lighting.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think in the climate information that we sent to policy, we put in the links to both the county's lighting policy and the city of SLO's lighting policy, and I think those would be good things to review as you do this. Mm-hmm. Also, like President Gray say, doing an inventory of what we've got and making a policy on what types of light we need to replace them with. And I agree on the issue of people leaving their lights on all night. We have a neighbor who is not here but once a month, and those lights are on 24/7. And the school, the elementary school, totally lights up my night sky.
Yeah. I mean, it's
but, so there's areas that we need to look at. But I also think that maybe Beautify Cambria can continue to encourage the county to accept the dark skies initiative, and then after that, so can we.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Mr. Green.
Yeah, there's also some rebates and incentives. I'm not sure what our bulb source is right now, but if you go from like mercury vapor to LED, there's some incentives and rebates for that. Yeah. So we might want to look into that as well.
I mean, going from, I don't know what, again, the inventory is important. Like, what kind of lighting do we have now, say in the streetlights? Is it mercury vapor? Is it LED? Probably LEDs in most of the building lights, I would think, at this point. But yeah, have to know that stuff. And then knowing what we can do and doing it. Dr. Farmer.
Over here.
Yeah.
Yeah, you made a comment a couple of minutes ago with regard to lighting and with regard to it being less in your face, and you said, keep it yellow. And so just to paraphrase the term, keep it yellow so we can be mellow.
Mellow, yeah.
Just thought I'd throw that out there.
That dates you.
Well, nobody else will, so I have to date myself, but thank you.
Director Thomas.
Yeah. Thank you, President Gray. Yeah. So, right, I think it's the right idea to keep it focused on what the district know,
can do.
Yeah, you know, can do, yeah. And recognize this is a first step. Get, you know, because you know, we've got a lot of things we want to influence. So get our house in order first, mm-hmm. And then once we get that, there's we have within our purview we have the municipal codes. I would see that as a next step, flowing from, but you know, not part of this scope,
yeah.
But a next step, and then using what we've done to, create some momentum.
Okay. Thank you. Yes. So, if there's no more discussion, I'll entertain a motion. Vice President Scott.
Yes, I move that the board direct the policy committee to develop a policy for streetlights and lights at other facilities under CCSD's jurisdiction.
We'll second that.
It's been moved and seconded that the board approve a policy regarding streetlights and lights at other facilities under CCSD's jurisdiction. Can I have a roll call, please?
Vice President Scott.
Aye.
Director Dean.
Aye.
Director Thomas.
Aye.
Director Farmer.
Aye.
President Gray.
Aye. On to, thank you. Thank you, Director Scott. Item 5E is discussion consideration of reading aloud written comments at board meetings. I'll turn this over first to staff, Mr. McElhenney.
Thank you, President Gray. As stated, agenda item 5E, discussion and consideration of reading aloud written comments at board meetings. There's no fiscal impact associated with this item. On September 12th, 2024, Director Farmer and Director Thomas requested placing reading aloud written comments submitted by the public during board meetings on a future agenda item. Prior to that, the discussion was that it was chair or president's prerogative to have those comments read aloud. The district, to provide some context in terms of what we call industry standard or what the standard is, at least around our community and our county, we didn't find or locate any government entity that reads aloud public comment at their board meetings. As we know, at least the board knows and staff knows, the genesis of this came about during COVID, where we enabled the public to submit written comment and have it read aloud. And that practice has continued. And just recently, it was discontinued by President Gray to not read them into the record, not to read them aloud. And now we're bringing it forward for the board to discuss and consider future guidance.
Thank you. Any questions of staff on this, just for clarification? I'll take this public comment first and come back for discussion. Is there any public comment for Mr. Howell?
Thank you. In my opinion, this board has been actually very good at the balancing that has to go on between receiving input from the public and conducting the public's business in a timely way. It's always, there's an inherent conflict in that situation. Having been in President Gray's position, I know how it can get to the point where you want to listen to people, but you also need to get the business done. So this board has been very good, generally. I don't get a sense that there's a pushing away of the public. And I'm saying this because largely not for you guys so much as for the people who may watch this later. This is not, I don't see this as an effort to muzzle the public. And again, just to General Manager McElhenney said and indicated that this practice arose during the pandemic when nobody could attend any kind of a meeting in person. So it was a way to keep the public involved, and we had to allow for the possibility of people who did not have computers or who were simply not literate with computers and couldn't use Zoom. So that was the practice, and was started under Cindy Seidel, and I also continued it. I want to remind the public that there is nothing preventing a person from coming in front of you and reading their comments. Nor is there anything preventing me, who cannot make a meeting, giving my written comment to someone else to come to the meeting and read. And I just want to remind people that this is not shutting people down, but what it does do is, again, you have to let the business has to go forward. And I think very importantly, something that we didn't think about when we did it originally, is that by having staff read the comment, it can do something to the, either it can imply that the staff is endorsing the position, or it can also, depending on the tone of voice, could be used the other way. So that's not a role that staff should be playing. And of course, it's not a role that the board should. A board member reading public comment, again, who's to distinguish between the board member and the public who's making the comment? It's a very, very dangerous situation to get in. I see that your timer's, I'm not sure where I am on that.
You're about 2 minutes.
So I'll just complete it by just reminding people, you can come. If you can't make it to the board meeting, you can have somebody else read your comment. Mm-hmm. The one caveat I would make, and it might need to appear somewhere, I mean, it's really the president's discretion. You cannot allow someone to come up with a sheaf of comments for 20 different people and read them. So it's one person, one live human being per comment. That should be the rule. But again, the public needs to understand they are not being muzzled here.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. By the way, there's a clock right in back of you, so I can always keep track of that, even if I forget to put this one on. And there's one there, too. Fine. That was fine, though. Thank you. Anybody else here wants to comment on this? Anyone want to comment via Zoom?
Yes, Christina Galloway.
Ms. Galloway.
Hi, Christina Galloway from Cambria. I just wanted to say, as somebody who's a very nervous public speaker, that, you know, sometimes it might be nice to be able to have a voice and not have to confront a public speaking fear. Especially if you don't, you know, aren't always in close connection with the few people that are actually available to attend the meetings in person. So, you know, I guess maybe I would just suggest that there'd be more conversation around how to, you know, bring things up to you guys, potentially for future meetings, or to be able to give input in a way that it can be discussed in a meeting, especially. So, yeah, maybe I agree. Maybe it doesn't make sense to always be reading people's public comments out loud, but it'd be nice to have like a clearer understanding of how you can have your voice heard if you're somebody who's not comfortable speaking publicly. And I know I hear from a lot of people at the NCAC who aren't comfortable speaking up in our meetings. And so I always try to advocate for them and their views. And so I just kind of wonder what you guys would do in lieu of, you know, not having the public comment being read out loud. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other public comment?
No.
Okay, thank you. I have to get this thing off. I'll bring this back to the board for discussion and a possible motion. Director Dean.
Okay, I want to give a little background on this. I've been attending board meetings for many years. And prior to COVID, written public comment was not read, nor did we have Zoom. People had to come in person to speak. If someone had a written comment and they couldn't be here, they would ask someone else to read that comment for them. When COVID hit, we were no longer in person, and we added the Zoom capability to our meetings. And because people could not attend in person, and some might not have a computer, as former President Howell said, we did read public comment as a courtesy to the public to give them more input. COVID's done. We continued with the expense of Zoom, so people could still call in on Zoom and speak in addition to being here in person. So you didn't have to be here in person. You can still sign on to Zoom. Now, I know that the general manager reached out to a lot of people to find out. And I also did a lot of research, and I also posted it on the CSDA forum. I found 3 people who responded that said they did the same thing we did during Zoom. But now that during COVID. But now that COVID is over, they discontinued Zoom and they discontinued reading public comment. However, they do stake public comment and they do post it to their website just like we do. And to me, having someone else who did not write that public comment read the public comment, you do not know what tone of voice, what attitude the person had while they wrote it. Are they angry? Are they frustrated? Are they being facetious? Or, you know, what exactly was the tone of voice that person meant it in? And I don't see how any one of us can read a public comment and know what the intent or the emotion was behind that comment. We take our public comment and we do post it to the website so people can read it later. And I like what President Gray did today, where he brought up the fact we had a couple of public comments that mentioned a couple of questions and asked for the response. I think that's a good way to handle it. And we do that with, I do that with my standing committee on R&I. If someone has questions, I try to make sure those questions are answered. I may not name the person, and I don't read it, but I do bring up the questions, and I try to get the answers. And I think that's the way we should handle it. I noticed also that one of the responses I got on the CSDA forum was that one of the agencies also had a deadline for people submitting public comment to be posted on the website, and it was far earlier than the 1 hour that we have. I mean, it gave more time for that to be posted and distributed to the board. But yet, so anyway, that's my opinion. I do not think we should be reading public comment out loud, but I also do not think it silences people.
Yeah. Thank you. Dr. Farmer.
Well, I think this discussion is has gone far beyond what I would have anticipated, and is I'm making a compliment here, and is somewhat illuminating and really creates a greater understanding of this issue and how to approach it. Since I was the one that initially brought it up, and I wanted to thank Mr. Director Thomas for kind of backing me up on this. Also, just what Director Dean pointed out, that earlier. You had General Manager McElhaney state, yes, we got two written comments, and you replied to both of them. You didn't read them, but you replied to both of them, and I think that's basically what anybody that is making a written comment would want, would be an answer to it. So I think if the opportunity to provide an answer to somebody's public comment, and I assume usually it's some type of answer as opposed to just a straight comment, I'm not sure, but... it sounds like things are being taken care of as best as possible. I still feel that, and maybe it's because it's Cambria, that, and I have such respect for the people that live in this community and their thoughts and ideas. That's probably the reason that I'm in favor of reading written comment aloud at board meetings. Getting back to Ms. Galloway saying that she's like nervous getting up in front of in front of people. If I'm not mistaken, public speaking is number one. Going to the dentist is number two, with regard to fears that people have. So, wow. So I'm more than willing to go along with what I hear from other folks here that perhaps we don't need it, at least right now, until we have a change in the seat next to myself here and readdress the issue perhaps. I'll leave it to somebody else to make a motion.
Okay, thanks. First of all, Director Thomas.
Oh, thank you, President Gray. Yeah, like most things, I looked at this and reflected and say, well, let's look at the data. So I looked at the went through the 10 meetings prior to the May 16th board meeting where President Gray announced that we were no longer reading written comments aloud. So I looked at the last 10 meetings, and interesting. On average, we have had four written comments per meeting. And the duration, on the recording, start and stop, the duration of under 6 minutes, on average. Two of those meetings were, let's just say, high energy meetings. We had the Coastal Union School District SR4 well site with 10 comments and 23 minutes.
And then going back, there was the strategic planning session where we also had the weed abatement and the WRF project description, and that had a record 12. And those were obviously outliers. If you throw those two out, we have on average, kind of like today, two written comments per meeting. And with which consume on average 2 minutes of meeting duration for reading those two written comments. So doesn't consume a whole lot of time. You know, I recognize absolutely it's not the practice consistent with most other government entities. Also recognize that after 4 years of the practice, our public has become accustomed to having the written comments read aloud. The pandemic has transitioned to an endemic a couple of years ago. It's been years since we've been in the pandemic, and so it's hard to say that we're changing this practice post-pandemic. So to me, the cons, the reasons to not do it, it reads, it takes some time. Yeah, a couple of minutes. And it's inconsistent with other entities. Now, timing-wise, the attention given to those written comments, most cases I'm watching on the website, I check, before lunch, I look, they're not posted yet, I'm waiting, okay, and then, because we have, them still coming in, and so sometimes I'm out and about, and I show up here at the meeting, and like, okay, what were the written comments? I have to look on my iPhone. I don't have the time to reflect on those written comments and perhaps, engage. It feels like we're, of course, if we see those sooner, that's better. I see it fairly, it's certainly not onerous in terms of the time it consumes for the board. So I've certainly heard a lot of pushback on changing the practice, and I'm quite happy to hear those written comments during the board meeting. So we'll let's. What else did I want to bring in? It's kind of effectiveness, efficiency. Maximum efficiency. Yep, just send us the written comments. Yeah, we can save time in the board meetings. We'll either read them or say that we read them. But effectiveness is being as well informed as we can on every issue. And so I want to hear what the public has to say. And like I said, in some cases, I'm out and about Thursday morning, show up here after lunch, and haven't really had the chance if they've come out within the last hour. So therein lies the challenge. And so I want to hear what the public has to say.
Thank you. Vice President Scott.
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. I'm not worried about efficiency.
Me.
I really want to hear what people have to say. But I also am concerned about someone, whoever it would be, reading a comment and insinuating something that person did not mean to say. So I have several suggestions. One would be that we do change the time frame, so it needs to be here 24 hours before. Secondly, I think that public comment is not only for the board members, it's also for whoever is attending and whoever is listening. So if we get it if we get the information 24 hours ahead of time, then it can be posted on the website. I also think that it would be helpful for the board members to have a copy of the public comment as part of our handout. Secondly, a copy of that could also be available with our agendas. So we could have whatever it is that got sent in should be posted with the agendas that we have for public consumption. I also think that if someone sends in an anonymous statement, that we should, that should not be put out, and that should not be part of what we take a look at, because that's what happens with social media. Is people can be on social media and say things in an anonymous way and not own what they're saying. And so I think people need to own what they're saying. Now, the number one best thing would be for people to come here, read their comment, give us the public comment written document so that we can have that as part of the record. But in the end, I think it's really the decision of the chair of the board to make the decision about how we handle that.
Thank you. Director Dean, thank you, Vice President.
And I agree, it's not the time it takes to read it. Yeah. And I really would prefer to hear the comment in a person's voice. I would really rather see the face of the person as they speak, but I'll settle for Zoom. Yeah. Because I agree with you, you don't know what the intent was or the emotion behind the comment if someone here reads it. And it's not fair to make staff read something where the comment is bashing their employer or their fellow staff members or the board. I don't think that's fair. People have a right to say it, but I don't think it's fair to make the staff or the board to read mm-hmm. those negative type things. And as far as it being the prerogative of the chair, so if you have a chair who doesn't want to read it and the next two chair wants to read it and then the next chair doesn't want to read it, it makes that next chair look really bad that they're trying to squash public comment. So I think we need to have a set policy about whether we are going to read public written public comment or not. I also agree there needs to be a deadline, a little more time between getting it and us getting it. I think people need to submit public comment at least the day before. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, otherwise it's kind of a rush to get it to us.
Mr. McElhenney.
Thank you, President Gray and Director Dean. I just wanted to follow up on Director Dean's comments. As far as staff is concerned, the efficiency, the time it takes, that's not really our concern. My primary concern as the general manager is the well-being of staff. And I can only imagine how uncomfortable it would be for Mrs. Dodson or whoever has to read that public comment to read something that is negatively aimed at whether it's her boss or Mr. Green or Mrs. Fritz. Yeah. It's just really unfair to ask staff to verbally say those things aloud. And for the most part, we have a public comment that is courteous and respectful, but there are times where we get public comment that is not so courteous. Mm-hmm. And as Vice President Scott alluded, there has been a certain enabling of the public to not have to show up and been enabled to say things without having to stare a human in the face. And like you mentioned, there is that culture in next door where we have those out there that can say these things and not have to look someone in the eye. So that's staff's concern. And it's my concern to protect staff and protect them feeling uncomfortable about potentially having to read a negative comment about their coworkers. Yeah. So that's where staff's coming from.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I had a couple comments. Director Farmer, you want more to say? Yeah.
I believe it was Director Scott that kind of alluded to this. It might have been Director Dean, but I think it was Director Scott, or Vice President Scott, excuse me. So the idea of receiving public comment within 24 hours before the meeting, it sounds like what would be a really good idea once we obviously we have the agendas available on the district website. So perhaps what we can do once we have the meeting and we say under public comment we had so many or whatever written public comments submitted, and you can read them under public comment on the agenda. So people could just go and look at, well, what was the agenda today, and there are the public comments under public comment.
Could do that. I mean, you're talking about them, people who are actually viewing the meeting or following the meeting on Zoom, or people who are here. I think what Director, Vice President Scott's suggestion was there'd be a handout with the agenda in the foyer there,
right,
that they could just pick up and bring in. But you're talking about people who are following on Zoom or on video, right?
Oh, anybody that would want to see if there was public comment. Maybe I'm a little off track here, but it seems like the idea of, obviously the agenda remains at the district website, you know, even after we've had the meeting. So people could use, they could watch to see if somebody spoke here in public comment, but if there was a written public comment, it could be just right there in the agenda under public comment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe I can kind of...
Dr. Dean.
...sign on to what Director Farmer's saying. So if we have a deadline that the public written public comment has to be submitted the day before, it can then be posted to the agenda.
Right.
And then when we have our meeting, we can say, we received this many public comments. They are on the website now attached to the agenda. So anybody watching the meeting on Zoom or following on home can go to the website and see what the current written public comment is.
Don't we have that now, though?
That's currently what we do, but we don't attach it to the agenda. We're not going to amend the agenda to include written correspondence, but it is posted on the website.
But it's on the website, so we can say it's on the website.
You should write under the agenda link.
Yeah.
A link to it.
Yeah, it's the agenda, any handouts, and then the written correspondence is posted below.
Put it in the same link, then, in other words.
Yep, it's the same link as the agenda.
So if it's on the same link the day before, when we have our meeting, we can say we received all these written comments and they are currently on the website.
Yeah. Okay. I think Dr. Thomas.
Yeah, thank you. And first, I just wanted to thank President Gray for allowing this public discussion, because this is very helpful. Mm-hmm. And the idea of revising the agenda the day before, to me, sounds inefficient. I like the idea that it's posted on the website. There's a link. We know where to find it.
Yeah.
But to revise the agenda to incorporate it, the agenda's set out a week prior. But it's, you know, as it is, it's on the same agenda page. And so
I could provide a clarifying summary of this concept. I think we're homing in on one proposal in particular about having a deadline that would allow all of us on the board and the public to read the public comment plenty of time before the meeting so we can digest it. I think that's something that, like, the day before, 24 hours before the meeting or something like that would be, I think we can agree on that pretty well. Whether it's a link, whether it is where it is now, which is a link right under the agenda, or somewhere else, I think that is less important than having the deadline. And then if there's any, and then, so Dr. Dean, you're saying if there's any comment that comes in after that, is there any sort of provision for that, or do we just say, you know,
as a handout?
Okay. Well,
but I was not saying to revise the agenda.
Right.
The way that Ms. Dodson is doing it now is a separate link on the page with the agenda. That's what I'm saying. So if you get it 24 hours ahead of time, it can be put on the same page on the website as a link below the agenda. Which is where it is now.
And Ms. Dodson, is that?
Yeah, that's correct.
That's practical,
So the minute I email you guys the written correspondence, it's posted on the website, and I send you guys the link as well.
I think the stuff that comes in really late, and Director Thomas was alluding to this, is sometimes something we just miss because we haven't had time to look at it. And I think I just had a couple of comments in general about this, but this is relevant to the whole deadline thing. I think people, what we owe people, actually, is a right for us to hear them. They want to make sure we are aware of what they're saying if we ask for public comment. And we're listening or reading, and in a way, the deadline, make the deadline earlier actually ensures that we'll have a chance to read what they're saying. And I think that's fair. It's actually a better system than we have now for ensuring that people have something to say in writing, we'll get it read by the board and seen by the public. So I think that really does sort of solve the problem in a lot of ways. The other thing I think should be pointed out is that people, of course, cannot only have people come here to speak and read their comment, but they can also have people do that on Zoom because we're continuing Zoom. So there's two outlets for people. Mm-hmm. And I don't see how, you know, it's not, again, with me, it's not about time and efficiency because we don't do that very much, but it's about, I think, being, you know, fair to the people who do come down here to put themselves out there and have their names, you know, have their names and faces visible to everyone and state the point of view. There's a certain amount of pressure there in getting up on that podium and speaking to us. And I don't think people should be somebody, you know, get special attention when they are able to do that, because that's something, that's your real act of citizenship by coming up and, you know, actually speaking to us. I think that should be favored as much as possible as the way to speak to us. Though even we make allowances for people in other situations, I think that should be favored. And I agree with Director Dean that this should be, ideally I'd like to be a policy that's in place that governs, even though I like having a lot of discretion as a president, and I'm sure the next president will too, certain things maybe almost protect the president from being the, you know, the bad guy. Yeah, exactly. And it makes it a consistent, you know, view of the board that this be, you know, be the practice no matter who's the president. I think I'd prefer that. So, but I would, I'm not going to make a motion. I'll ask for a motion first, but there's still lights on.
Yeah.
But I think my views are that we're homing in on the solution with the deadline. And I think we should make it a policy. We're not going to read anything aloud, but we're going to have plenty of time for people to write stuff, bring, you know, have it presented to us, and then we can talk about it if we have to, like we did today, in full awareness that everybody else has been able to see it too. Everybody else watching the meeting or everybody else at the meeting. So, Dr. Thomas.
Great summary, and thank you, President Gray. And I wanted to ask, it sounds like potentially one of the elements of the motion, and I have a sense that we don't need to send this for a policy. I think we will state the practice, and we'll take a vote, and that will be setting the policy here and today. One of the ideas that came up was to have no not include anonymous comments, and I just wanted to verify with legal counsel that that's fair game. I tend to agree because it's important to hear, like, I hear where you're coming from, and so let's hear from Mr. Carmel.
Yeah, I would like to ask that question too, actually, because I know that Brown Act allows people to come forward and not give their name at a meeting, correct?
It does.
Yeah.
It's a tricky question. I think you can. I think you can have a policy that says we won't read anonymous letters. I think one other fact that I haven't heard discussed, and it's something you should consider, is that some commentators will write distasteful, discriminatory, mean, cruel comments filled with stuff you would have a hard time reading publicly. And I don't know who's going to make the determination as to whether it can be censored or not, what criteria you're going to use, and how those are going to be dealt with. You know, hopefully they never happen. I think the reality of it is this can be abused. And I think if we're not careful in framing the policy, and I think it needs to be written, I don't think this is something you want to just read into a record because it carries with it a price tag. You know, lawsuits happen out of First Amendment issues like this. I think those are things you need to consider in dealing with the issue. But I do think you could structure it so that written comments that are anonymous could probably be prohibited.
Thank you. Dr. Dean.
Can we ask Mr. Carmel to draft this for us?
Well, I was going to say we direct staff and council together.
Yes.
To draft a procedure or, you know, a rule on public comment and bring it back to us at the next meeting or next, you know, next time, next time at a convenient, earliest possible convenient time.
The other thing is, could it be in the bylaws?
I was going to ask that too. Is this something we should put in the bylaws once we've got it all worked out?
I think it needs to be in some form that's documented on that level.
Yeah.
It's actually pretty important. And you could see it has the components of some legal issues that are pretty complicated. I don't think we could bring something back that quickly. I think this has to be carefully analyzed before it comes back to you.
Okay.
So thinking that, okay, if we're landing on a future where we're not reading these aloud during board meetings, then, aw, shucks, whatever comments come in, anonymous or not, they can be included in the package of information. We will read them. Well, we will be able to take them with whatever grains of salt, pepper, or cayenne that we choose. So,
I'm inclined to say that we should do a we should not drop the idea of excluding anonymous written comment. I think we should, you know, because that I think you are opening a Pandora's box if you allow that. So I think I would entertain a motion to I think what we're talking about is directing. We do have to send this to council. It will end up as a bylaw in the bylaws, but to direct staff and council to come back with a proposal, which would to be incorporated later in the, to be incorporated in the bylaws to state a policy on whether or not we read written comment and when the deadline is for turning it in.
Thank you, President Gray. Yeah. Just for clarification, you're directing us to create some changes to the bylaws that prohibit that we are not allowing written public comment to be read aloud, that written public comment has to be submitted 24 hours ahead of time. Is there any other guidance that the board would like to provide as we amend these changes?
That sounds.
Are we asking them to amend the bylaws? Are we asking them to bring us back a policy that we will eventually put into the bylaws?
Bring back a policy, not a policy. You know, we amend the bylaws, but yeah, bring back a policy. And again, this is to get both the staff and council to make sure the language is effective and defensible.
Understood. And so we'll direct a policy based on today's conversation.
I have. Yeah. I wouldn't call it a policy.
I wouldn't call it policy because
I would
it's
say
a bylaw.
Guidelines to be incorporated into the bylaws after it's accepted by the board.
Okay.
Or approved, yeah.
We have a set of operating. We have a set of operating principles. I mean, it's similar to that.
Okay. I think we don't get too hung up on terminology. What we're doing is we're going to add wording to our bylaws regarding this issue.
Right.
We want to make sure the wording works and doesn't get us in trouble.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Perhaps is there, because this is a discussion and consideration, and maybe I'm not understanding this, Mr. Carmel, but is there a motion to direct staff to create these guidelines in a specific way?
We haven't made the motion yet, so I'm just trying to get somebody can make the motion along the lines of what we're saying. If somebody can make a specific motion, then we can clear that up, hopefully. Vice President Scott?
Yes, I'd like to make a motion.
Okay, please do.
Yes, thank you. I move that the board direct staff and legal counsel to create guidelines for how to handle written public comment during the meetings.
I second. I think that's sufficient.
Yeah, because they heard what we said.
Okay, so we don't have to include any of the other things we said into the motion. We're going to count on him going back and listening to this.
I don't mean to be difficult in any way, but The board decides is going to make ultimately a decision on how to handle the written public comment. I believe it would be beneficial for staff if there was a decision on the direction we are going rather than us designing the guidance. Maybe a clearer picture in the motion that would say create it. Mr. Carmel, am I off base?
Let
me amend
Do we need to include staff or just do council? Since this is a byline issue.
Yeah.
Just council, isn't it?
Well, no, I would appreciate the help of staff.
Okay,
I think you. It's been a very, beneficial discussion and robust. There are a lot of ideas, and I think it's going to have to go one or two steps further because a lot of them are divergent ideas. But I don't think we need you right now to outline the elements that you think should be included in the guidelines. Let us spend a little time looking around and seeing as hopefully someone's been here before. That's generally the way we like to create things, and see what's out there, and then maybe come back with something general in an outline form. I don't think this can be done very quickly, because there are significant legal issues involved.
Okay, thank you.
So do you like my motion?
I do.
So I'll procedure. There's a motion. Director Thomas, do you have anything to say? No.
Oh, and there was a second.
Yeah, there's a second, exactly. It's been moved and seconded that staff and council prepare a guidelines for treatment of written public comment in meetings and report back to the board, obviously. A roll call.
Vice President Scott?
Aye.
Director Thomas?
Aye.
Director Dean?
Aye.
Director Farmer?
I'm going to say aye. I just wanted a clarification. I had my light on, but so with regard to either written or public comment, our response as board members should be brief, if at all, right?
Yes. Yeah. Always with public comment. You don't want to get in long wrangles. And I'll say aye, too.
Yeah, President Gray.
Yeah. Motion passes 5-0. I think we'll probably get done in the next few minutes. We have...
May I just...
Yes, Director Dean.
Okay, one of the CSDs that responded to my question on the CSD forum did create a policy regarding this, including the deadlines and all of that. Would it be helpful if I send that to staff?
Yes.
Okay.
Staff and council. Yeah, great. Yeah, so we have coming up, we have actually in our reports, I think we have, let me just list them here, written reports from Finance Committee, Policy Committee?
No.
No Policy Committee. We have PROS, R&I, and the R&I report was a correction made and a new version sent to us, given to us by Director Dean. You might want to just mention what that is. And then the liaison reports, which I believe include a Forest Committee and this in a second here. FFRP, yeah, FFRP. First of all, any questions for the on the reports or comments? Clarification from Director Thomas.
Thank you, and I want to apologize for use of a 7-letter acronym in the report, the PROS Committee report. It's interesting because I heard USLTRCD so many times. Wondering what on earth this thing was, and it took me months to at least be able to say the Upper Salinas Los Tablas Resource Conservation District. So a good friend pointed that out to me, that I'd use that acronym, so apologies for that. And just, for those who don't know, the Upper Salinas Los Tablas Resource Conservation District, established in 1951 as a special local district, and there are over 3,000 resource conservation districts nationwide with a presence in every U.S. county. And their focus, obviously, greatly is about forest management, but it's resource conservation in every aspect. A lot of focus on agriculture, and they do a lot of good, and they definitely do a lot of good for us. But just wanted to point that out, and since I'd failed to define that acronym, I thought I would give a brief blurb. So that's that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments or clarifications? I have one very brief one on page 362 of the agenda, which is my report. Right under the item 4A in the first paragraph under the title, I misspelled the name of our general manager. So if that could be corrected in the first line there.
Yeah, that's more like Hugh McElhaney.
Right. Yeah. And is there any public comment on these reports? In the hall here, or is on Zoom?
No.
None, okay. Without further ado, I think we go to future agenda items. Yeah. And I think I can invite anyone who wants to suggest an item. You notice that future agenda items sometimes produce a lot of discussion when they get back on the agenda.
Yeah.
So anyone have a suggestion for something on the agenda, to put something on the agenda? I'll start with Dr. Thomas.
Yeah. Thank you, President Gray. Yeah, go around the table. We have a revised board schedule and standing committee schedule coming next year, and we're combining from two board meetings to one. It's already one heck of a fire drill from Friday. In rare cases, thank you very much, Ms. Dodson, sometimes on Thursday getting the board agenda packet, but generally Friday, it's, you know, by the end of the day, and boy, that's one heck of a weekend, you know, consuming that. So my request is that we set a timeline. We set an expectation for delivery. And, I mean, I led hundreds of project reviews in corporate life, and we set a 2-week delivery on the pre-reading package. And if the project team didn't get it to us, I said, all right, we're rescheduling. And they didn't like that, but the the peer review team just can't, anyway. So to bring it back to the board, I would like to see early the prior week, if we're going to have the meeting on the third Thursday, I would like to see like Tuesday, the week before or thereabouts. We can negotiate on the day, but certainly not at the end of that week. Because if we have it, Monday or Tuesday the prior week, we have plenty of time to we still won't have plenty of time, but at least we'll have a couple extra days and we can dig into it that week. So that's my ask, is that we set a timeline requirement that we get the agenda packet out by or defer the meeting.
Okay. Thank you. We'll, just so everybody understands what's happening here, we can't have discussion about any particular item, but we can, and if there's a people wanted on the agenda, if the board wants the agenda, they can always take a vote 3-2 to put it in the agenda, or a majority vote to put it in the agenda. But otherwise, the proposal goes to the general manager and the president of the board to decide, and the president in agenda review. So that's where we'll go at this point. Anything else? Vice President Scott.
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. We have our comprehensive strategic planning sessions coming in a few months. Mm-hmm. And so I would like to have on the agenda some brainstorming about what we have now and how we might want to see changes in it, mm-hmm. so that we can not only get that information from the board, but also from staff and also from any public that wants to come in. Mm-hmm. Not the gathering of information like we will do later on from the public, but just kind of overarching umbrella kind of changes that you might want to look at. And then I believe at that point there'll be an ad hoc committee that'll be assigned. So.
Yeah.
Put that on.
Thank you. Yeah, I think what you're saying is we're not reopening, we're not doing a plan, but we're talking about the structure of how we do the plan and reviewing what people would like to see changed in the way it's done. Yeah, that I guess the earliest opportunity for that would probably be in November.
Yeah. Last year by this time, the ad hoc committee
had
their proposal finished, and that was for a minor update. Here we're going to a major update. So it's a bit...
Yeah. Well, just in terms of time, people should know this too, I think. We've been talking to Dick Clark, who is interested in doing it again, which is great. His availability really is in March, because I think Director Dean can fill you in on that too.
He's totally available in February. In March, he's not available on the 10th and the 11th.
Okay, so yeah,
Other than that, he's available.
He's available, yeah, for February and most of March. That's right. So last year, the process basically went through February and into early March. So it's probably, I think if we do things expeditiously, we can make those dates again. So, but yeah, this, if we start in November on the review essentially of where how we've done this, I think that would be, we'd probably put that in the agenda, but we'll see about the details of that. Dr. Dean.
The ad hoc committee on the bylaws worked on the changes to the bylaws based on what the role of the board member was for the standing committees, but we also have some changes when it comes to how many times a month we have meetings and all of that. And I would like to bring forward to, as a future agenda item, to discuss reinstating that ad hoc committee to work on those changes based on the changes of how often we're having meetings.
Okay, any further, there's also any further bylaws. It's not just the when we're having meetings, but also the three-hour rule.
Right.
Has to be revisited. I've also noticed I've noticed this in the some discussions already about the procedure for rotating the presidency. There's a problem with, at least one problem with the language where they refer to the top vote getter in the last election. And we just had an election when nobody got any votes, technically. Things like, there's little things like that, I think, that have to be revisited. I would suggest the current ad hoc is Dr. Dean and Vice President Scott, right? I don't know if this is out of line for the president to do this, because I can appoint an ad hoc. Can I task an ad hoc? I think.
Sure.
I'll go ahead and task them with basically visiting both those provisions. We have to do the schedule provisions, obviously, by the time we adopt the new schedule, which I think is currently going to be in December on the agendas. So, and also revisit the troublesome language we have in section 1.4A is basically where the presidency and vice presidency and rotation and all that stuff is taken up.
Yeah, for what it's worth, I went through the logic of that and ran the next 4 years out. And even though there's no election, the statement of the one who has not held that position the longest still works. So if you read through that and apply the logic, it's quite straightforward who would rotate for the next 4 years. Mm-hmm.
We'll see.
I'm happy to give you. I did it on a diagram, just the way put it all into perspective. So.
So I'll leave that up the ad hoc to see if there's anything that needs to be changed, essentially in the scheduling. Thank you. So I guess any other suggestions for items? Because we'd have to extend the meeting slightly if we were. So, not that we can't. No further agenda items? Okay, so this meeting is adjourned.